Welcome to another episode of the Blockchain Debate Podcast, where consensus is optional, but proof of thought is required. I'm your host, Richard Yan. Today's motion is, today's blockchains can't increase TPS without taking a hit on decentralization, part two. This is a follow-up debate, or you can think of it as a rematch. Previously, Amre from O1 Labs also debated Anatoly from Solana on this very topic on the show. So make sure to check that out if you're interested. Here are the things we discussed. The inherent shortcoming of proof of stake in guaranteeing the canonical chain for a new full node. Why some chains have been designed to disallow rollback beyond certain point. How Evan thinks faster syncing process for new full nodes will allow further decentralization. Why Anatoly thinks trustless syncing doesn't solve the general's problem. And more. If you're into crypto and like to hear two sides of the story, be sure to also check out our previous episodes. We feature some of the best known thinkers in the crypto space. If you would like to debate or want to nominate someone, please DM me at BlockDebate on Twitter. Please note that nothing in our podcast should be construed as financial advice. I hope you enjoy listening to this debate. Let's dive right in. Welcome to the debate, consensus option of proof of thought required. I'm your host, Richard Yan. Today's motion, today's blockchains can't increase TPS without taking a hit on decentralization. In my metaphorical left is Evan Shapiro, arguing for the motion. He agrees that today's blockchains can't increase TPS without taking a hit on decentralization. To my metaphorical right is Anatoly Yakovenko, arguing against the motion. He disagrees that today's blockchains can't increase TPS without taking a hit on decentralization. That is basically saying blockchains can scale without sacrificing decentralization. Now, this is a rematch. A few months ago, Amre Tekeshap from Mina, which was called Coda at the time, had a debate on this topic with Anatoly. And I look forward to seeing updates in their thinking in today's discussion. Gentlemen, I'm super excited to have you join the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Here's a bio for the two debaters. Evan is CEO of O1 Labs, which operates Mina Protocol, previously known as Coda Protocol. He used to be an engineer at Mozilla and personal robotics lab at Carnegie Mellon University. Anatoly is founder and CEO of Solana, a layer one public blockchain built for scalability without sacrificing decentralization or security, and in particular, without sharding. He was previously a software engineer at Dropbox, Mesosphere, and Qualcomm. So we normally have a few rounds. There's opening statement followed by host questions. Currently, our Twitter poll shows that 70% agree with the motion and 20% disagree with the motion. After the release of this recording, we'll also have a post-debate poll. Between the two polls, the debater with a bigger percentage change in his or her favor wins the debate. Okay, Evan, please go ahead and get started with your opening statement.
When you have a blockchain, it's extremely important that everyone's able to access it and that it's not going to be possible to censor people. It's not going to be possible to limit who can access the chain. It's not going to be possible to really just treat people differently depending on who they are, how they're accessing it and such. And it becomes much harder to provide those kinds of guarantees as you increase the throughput of today's blockchains. As you increase the throughput, the cost to a user of actually connecting to the chain, verifying it, and knowing they're using it in a trustless, safe way increases as you have to look at the actual transactions that were underlying the chain and understand that they're correct, understand like where that leaves you in terms of the state of the blockchain. And what this means is that blockchains today have become pretty hard to use. If you look at even like blockchains like Bitcoin and Ethereum, which have pretty low throughputs, it's still hundreds of gigabytes to run a node and connect to the network. And that is something that is feasible if you're a programmer with a server and access to a cloud machine or your own desktop. It's something that's already out of reach of regular people, and it becomes magnified as you increase throughput even more to limit the set of folks that can connect to cryptocurrencies.
Okay, great. Anatoly, please go ahead.
So I guess fundamentally, what decentralization means to me is a solution to the general's problem. Like what we're building is solving that hard computer science problem. And fundamentally, that is building a censorship-resistant network that guarantees that messages can be delivered between all the generals and they can decide to attack Constantinople. So in my mind, like solving that problem, the only way to solve it is to increase the size of the network to such a high degree of nodes that participate in consensus that the possibility of disrupting it approaches zero. And the only way to do that is actually to increase throughput and increase TPS. That my stance is that you can't actually solve this problem without scaling the fundamental core TPS part of blockchain.
Okay. So a quick follow-up question to both of you there. So Anatoly, your point of having to increase TPS in order to enhance the network and enforce decentralization, I think that totally makes sense. Are you able to speak about the approach being undertaken at Solana in hopes of increasing that TPS, which subsequently increases decentralization?
The way we've undertaken this is when you look at the actual network and the number of nodes that participate in consensus, those messages that are votes that actually guarantee safety and liveness, they're transactions. So there's no way to increase that set without increasing the capacity of the network to handle a higher TPS. And no matter what you do, no matter how you try to hide that fact, when you're trying to synchronize a large enough network, if you try to shard it, you actually reduce that set. If you try to aggregate those messages, you create Eclipse attack vectors. There's no way to do this without actually creating a bigger pipe and maximizing that set of nodes. Imagine a network with 10,000 machines equally staked. You need at least 3,334 machines to be compromised for those Byzantine fault tolerant guarantees to be broken. And the only way to like guarantee that 10,000 set is participating in consensus is to increase the capacity of that network for cryptographic operations.
Okay. I actually don't think Evan necessarily disagrees with what you're saying there, but the crux of the issue today, the difference of opinion today, is whether blockchains that are designed today are able to do what's being described. So Evan, are you able to speak to why you believe that today's blockchains aren't able to do what Anatoly said?
Yeah, and I think this is interesting because it really gets into the design decisions that blockchains have been making and are making now. I would actually maybe disagree slightly on the claim that we have to increase throughput immensely in order to perform consensus. I think it depends on the consensus algorithm that is running under the hood. If it's something like Byzantine, if it's like a traditional BFT algorithm that requires the two-thirds, one-third honest property, like then yes, you need like everyone to communicate all the time, and it requires you to increase your throughput a lot if you're going to increase the number of nodes in the network. But there's other options out there as well. For example, in proof of work, from a consensus standpoint, there's nothing throughput-wise you would imagine at first, like stopping you from being able to run with a huge number of nodes, because every slot is only one block, you're pretty good there. The problem is, as you start increasing the number of transactions that are besides your consensus transactions, and you start just adding user transactions on, because if you're going to use the blockchain and the blockchain's been around for a year, you have to validate all the transactions that have been around for that year, which means that depending how many transactions have been made, it's going to be more or less work for you as the user.
Okay. But what you're describing as a drawback there isn't a TPS problem, though. So I think what you're talking about is a syncing problem, if you will. So if something's getting on the network quite late, or something has been disconnected from the network and comes back, then it needs to basically download and then validate these transactions one by one, and it takes a really long time. And I believe that was like, for Bitcoin, it's on the order of 5 or 6 hours on a certain set of hardware requirement. And so I get that that is a problem that your protocol, Mina, is looking to address. But that's not the TPS problem we're talking about today, is it?
We think it is. Yes, the thing I keep coming back to is syncing. And I think that like there's a reason for that. That's where you get the trustless access from when you sync. And with today's blockchains, as you increase the throughput, it becomes harder to sync and therefore harder to get this trustless access. So they're connected concepts.
Okay. And this is where I think like Evan and I are, I think I disagree with them, but because I think like their approach is totally interesting to build a chain that solves that problem. The reason I disagree with them is that I don't think trustless syncing solves the end general's problem. Like in the way that proof of work solves it, but not in a very like efficient way. So if you look at Ethereum and Bitcoin today, mining is concentrated around a few mining pools. And there's about three nodes in Ethereum that you need to control the signing, like keys for those blocks, to be able to prevent messages passing through the network. If I have my armies, right, surrounding Constantinople, and I use Ethereum as my message bus, Constantinople needs to bribe 3 miners to prevent my messages from getting across. That is a kind of a very simple thing, like to think about. Treat these networks as an implementation of a censorship-resistant, like, message layer, right? Like just a simple message bus. And the number of clients that you can synchronize and guarantee that Byzantine fault-tolerant communication, right, on top of these networks, that's kind of like the limiting factor here. The attack vector is simply bribing those 3 nodes, or is somewhat economically infeasible to do a very large rollback. But it's not economically infeasible to bribe the Ethereum miners and prefer certain USDT transfers between Binance and Coinbase versus others, because nobody will notice that one particular hedge fund gets their transfers across before everyone else.
And I agree with this, actually. I think there's a couple measures of decentralization, but for the actual like core Byzantine, you know, generals part of this, yeah, I think there's a lot to be gained both from existing cryptocurrencies, and there's like fronts besides TPS for decentralization to make TPS versus decentralization, yeah, to make progress on.
Okay. Maybe let's go back a little bit. So the reason why we had this debate in the first place was this MENA article that touched upon this concept of TPS per decentralization. And so, Evan, are you able to elaborate for us how that number is calculated?
Yeah, totally. So we were spending time thinking through the difficulty of syncing on different networks. And what we realized at one point was like, why don't we actually just go out and measure like, you know, how many full nodes there are in a network, which is for us a proxy of how hard it is to run a full node to the throughput that the network supports. And if you draw this, you get a pretty like straightforward relationship between the two. As throughput goes up, the number of full nodes you observe on a network go down. If you look at something like Bitcoin and Ethereum, like the two chains that have been keeping their gas or their block size pretty low, they have a pretty high number of full nodes. It's been like either flat or declining, which we would argue is because the, you know, chains are still getting longer, but they have like around 10,000 full nodes. But then when you start looking at chains which support higher throughputs, you start seeing chains that have in the as low as the tens, feel like an EOS or a Tron, up to like hundreds or mid-hundreds for chains with middle throughput. So this led us to developing this concept of like decentralization versus scale, which we think is like pretty observable in the wild if you just look at blockchains. And we're hoping to break out of by removing this connection between having to grow this like ever-growing blockchain as you increase the throughput of your chain.
Interestingly enough for us, our validator numbers have been doubling. So on testnet, it's near 600, like 570. And on mainnet, it's 370. And that's because nodes, when they join the network, don't sync the whole thing. They actually just look at the whatever last snapshot that's been finalized. And if you look at any proof of stake network or a lot of the proof of work networks outside of Bitcoin and Ethereum, to make these weak subjectivity assumptions about the last block that can be rolled back by any client. So if you make those assumptions, there's actually no point for consensus to store that history. It's actually it's not going to change the consensus mechanisms of any of the nodes. They will, in fact, continue running regardless whether they see those blocks that have rolled back. They'll simply reject them. So you don't actually need to sync anything else besides that last weak subjective checkpoint. If you're building a proof of stake network, for the majority of the world, this is what everyone has designed, is that Ethereum, ETH2, every like EOS version, every Tron version, every Cosmos fork has some notion of we'll never roll back past a certain point. So that kind of syncing doesn't really like impact like those kinds of weakly subjective networks. And I think the folks haven't really talked about, and I think is the potentially an insight that isn't obvious, is that I think if you look at these networks, not the non-proof of work ones, what you have is a VeriSign certificate chain, like a very large one with a lot of signers and this very long one. Just like in VeriSign, when you enter like a certificate, you verify the root through some out-of-band means. The you go in and actually look around and make this weak subjective kind of computation. Hey, what is the actual network that I care about? What is that instance? How do I connect to it? And once you establish that chain, right, the protocol ensures that it won't be broken. So that is, in fact, like the only thing that a proof of stake network needs to do. I boot up my node, I discover the network, I connect to it. The protocol, the software guarantees that assumption will be broken. And then out of band, I verify, hey, am I on the network that me as a human actually care about? And if that's true, right, then I can get my armies and communicate over this network and attack Constantinople.
Anatoly, in terms of a new full node that gets connected to the network, your argument seems to be that the full node doesn't need to download the entire history. It just needs to go back to a certain point. What reference does that full node have for that? How does it know like where to get the latest copy, and at what point does it need to sync up to?
So that delta of how much history is lost is defined really by the network protocol. There's some threshold, which is this is the maximum slashing distance, right? If two, I think it's 90 days. So for consensus, it doesn't really matter if you have history that's older than 90 days, because there's nothing you can do with it to impact consensus. It becomes useless data. With proof of work, right, if you have an alternative fork that's 90 days old, you can start doing work on it. And if you end up building a heavier chain, it'll actually change the true proof of work. The objective thing is that if you build a heavier fork, no matter how old it is, the entire network will switch over to it. With proof of stake, you have a cutoff. This is fundamentally, I think, to me, there's almost two different ways to do censorship resistance. Ethereum Classic get a 4,000 block rollback. That is a demonstration of proof of work censorship resistance, because it guarantees that eventually the heaviest fork will win. But that is different than guaranteeing that when I send a message right now, that I have some guarantees about it reaching my like armies, right, within a short amount of time, or that my hedge fund gets to transfer funds between USDT and Binance with some fair assumptions. So there's, to me, it seems like there's a proto-efficient space here for trade-offs. For work, like real classic proof of work is one. And our approach, we're really maximizing this set of nodes that can participate in consensus, and therefore maximizing the minimum set that have the control over the liveness threshold. Effectively, that is the set that decides whether any block is going to be accepted or rejected by the network. So if you maximize the set, you effectively create a more robust censorship-resistant message bus. And therefore, that is the true meaning of decentralization.
Yeah, and I actually want to take this back to syncing and respond to Anatoly's previous comments.
Yeah.
So I think... So I guess like maybe like we can use it like this mental model is helpful. If you are just like someone who's watching this battle happening and you want to actually observe what's happening on the network and you want to join in and see what the state of the world is, then you need some way to synchronize to this thing and actually know you're talking to the right set of generals that have been around since the time started and that they're actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. And I think what's really exciting about proof of stake, and I think what Anatoly was getting into, is like, there is like a really wide design space that we can choose between. We can go as far as, we can say if we want to that we can just throw out old history if we want to, so we don't have to think about that. But I think the right question is, what set of assumptions is this new person having to make if they're going to join the network? I think this is really key, because this is what allows you to make the decision whether or not you're going to have to care about this throughput problem or not. Because if you want to, you can throw away the history and you can say that I'm going to choose a trust model with which I don't have to look at the whole history. And that's a very different trust assumption if you want. But if you want to, you can also say that I will make no such assumption about trusting the current state of the network. I want to actually see a proof that the network's been operating correctly since the beginning of time. If we really want to maximize decentralization, for users to have to figure out if they're on like the right recent part of the chain or not, they should be able to just join from Genesis. I think this is key, because even if you are sending these cryptographic messages around and have a really efficient protocol for sending them around on, what's important is that you're sending them around to the real set of generals.
So I think that if you are building a proof of stake network, it is impossible to guarantee who the real set of generals are, because you can always lose old keys and somebody can create an alternative fork that has passed whatever rollback history you started with.
Yeah, this is the long range attack. Yes. So I think, yeah, the assumption you have to make here, if you want to be secure, is you have to make the assumption that at no point in time let me know also this is what you're referring to, like at no point in time has any party had more than 51% of the stake at any time, because if they did, they can go back in time and create this really long fork. Or is that
those keys could have been stolen, those keys could have been leaked, they could have simply, somebody could offer a market for old staking keys once they're rotated, they lose value. I can simply buy those private keys. And eventually, like, an attacker could accumulate like enough old keys from previous history and then can create alternative forks. And the only way to deal with that is with some weakly subjective assumptions. And my personal belief is once you start taking those assumptions one inch, you're not losing any security by using those assumptions strictly, by having to validate those assumptions anyways. So as soon as I connect to the network, for me to actually know whether I'm connected to the real network, any proof of stake network, I have to validate that the signers in this network are what I expect. So how do I do that? I think the way it depends on the application and what you care about from the network itself. If all you care about is value transfer, then you can literally go to Binance and make sure that you can transfer from Binance to your account and back into all the exchanges that you care about. And then it doesn't matter if it's a long-range attack, because the financial institutions that you're connected to, your generals are connected to, are all in the same long-range attack network. And your nodes guarantee that connection remains secure. So that kind of, like, to me, is there's no way around this except for Nakamoto proof of work.
There's actually a really interesting metaphor here with proof of work that, like, I think is like somewhat relevant and is, I think, really fascinating. If you look at the current hash rate on Bitcoin right now, it's very high. But if you look at all the hardware that has been created since the beginning of time for Bitcoin, it's much higher. So if someone was to go out there and get a truck or probably an army of trucks and collect all these old machines, they could perform 51% attack pretty feasibly. And this is like the hardware version of this, like, stealing the keys attack. I think the metaphor holds. What's, I think, cool with proof of stake is that there are schemes by which you can, honest nodes can effectively destroy their old keys and replace them with new ones on a periodic basis. So this is similar to if miners, whenever they upgrade their ASICs, had to smash all their old ASICs or something. Probably not going to happen, but because it's software, it's easy to program in by default. I do think a big question here is whether or not, if once a system exists, will people actually go in and start, like, disabling that so they can save their old keys? So eventually, if they want to defect, they can. But I think we have a little more wiggle room in creating a little more possibility of safety under this paradigm, where we can make it pretty hard for an attacker to get the stake necessary.
So I think while an attack in proof of work can destroy, like, the value of that coin, it doesn't actually destroy the network, right? Like, the Ethereum Classic rollback with 4,000 blocks added security to the network. So even if somebody takes all the hardware and 51% attacks Bitcoin, like, the assumptions of proof of work are kind of that is the actual network, and what it did is it overcame censorship. And that may be useless for an application or for humans, but that is the fundamental thing about proof of work. And that kind of Nakamoto style consensus is that the older my coins are, the more security the network accumulates, and that possibility approaches zero. You can't replicate that with proof of stake. Like, you can make the safety improvements that you talked about, which is automatically destroy keys, and it makes it really hard for an attacker to go buy them up. But that's not something that you can guarantee forever. And I personally think that the fact that those attacks can happen at proof of work makes the chain more secure, but pretty useless for humans. So broken from that perspective.
Yeah, I agree.
One of the updates from the last debate was this idea of whether full nodes are as important as consensus nodes. And I remember when Anatoly was debating Omri last time, there was a long discussion of whether full nodes were relevant in resolving disputes in the ledger. So any updated thoughts on this, Anatoly?
So I think the way we've been framing decentralization is in this, like, maximizing the set of nodes that can halt the network. I don't think full nodes are important because effectively this is the hack that we're doing, right? Nakamoto chose this hack where any heaviest fork wins, and that breaks a lot of applications when that happens, but increases the security of the network. The hack that we're taking is you maximize the set, which means that it becomes really hard to halt the network or censor it. And the other nodes that are participating, that are downloading the ledger, are basically RPC nodes. They're there to scale reads and, like, scale, like, kind of infra and stuff like that, but they don't count for consensus. They don't count for censorship resistance. To me, they're as useful when you're counting, like, when people make these charts of who has more nodes, those nodes are as useful as GitHub stars. They're like a sign of adoption because people go and run them, but because they're not actually there to help those end generals, right, to attack, they don't actually count.
Yeah, my take is that the number of the nodes that exist is more of an indication of something rather than a huge win in and of itself. The thing that I think is important here is we have, I guess, this notion of what is, like, the halting set of the network? How big can we make that? And I think that's one notion of decentralization, but I think there's, like, another half to the coin, which is, like, how hard is it as a user to get access to this system? How hard is it for me to either join this set of consensus nodes or just perform a transaction without being beholden to some exchange or some other entity? And number of full nodes isn't necessarily an indicator of how easy it is, but it does go, like, you know, some ways towards showing how easy it is. I think that's what really matters. As a user, if I want to, you know, access some decentralized app, is that going to be something that requires me, like, a desktop with a lot of time, or is it something that I can do on my phone?
Okay, interesting. It sounds like the position on full nodes has really evolved on you guys and Evan. Okay, so Anatoly, just to follow up on something else you mentioned last time with regard to centralized exchanges dictating the way the ledger looks. So since our last discussion, there's been lots of FUD for exchanges, OKX, KuCoin, BitMEX, Binance getting regulatory heat too. So is the movement toward a self-custodied world being accelerated? And if so, aren't full nodes getting more important more quickly as well?
Like, I would like that to be true. You saw Infura went down and a bunch of Ethereum applications, basically, and the exchanges connected to Ethereum stopped withdrawals. So I think, like, humans are just remarkably lazy. And this is where I will concede to Mina, and, like, I think it is what they're building is really cool, is that if you can make the shelling point, like, of running a full node so low that you'd rather do that than run Infura, then you end up with networks that have social resilience, where if the set of validators is small and you may not have the same liveness properties from, let's say, Solana, this is the only thing we're focused on, that if that set is corrupted, everybody immediately knows, right? Everybody immediately knows that something went wrong. There's something interesting there when you maximize the watchers. We're trying to maximize the watchmen. And I think there's a different approach where you can have a small set of, like, consensus nodes and a very large set of observers. And that has some interesting properties in itself. So I don't know what is, like, the trends. I think reality is that humans are pretty lazy and they will just do whatever works. If you can make whatever works have high security guarantees for the most part, that may allow you to scale that network to very high, security margins, like, in a cheaper way.
Okay. And this question is for Anatoly again. In our last debate, you said you were okay with Lite clients and SPV clients being the norm for how users access the network. So two follow-up questions there. So first of all, what is the minimum requirement for running a full node and a consensus node in Solana? Give us a dollar price. And secondly, do you have any theory on the acceptable threshold of the number of Lite SPV clients versus the number of full nodes for a network to be considered secure?
So again, from our design perspective, what we're focusing on is maximizing that set of participants that can hold the network. So it doesn't matter how many Lite clients there are or aren't, because that doesn't impact that key core feature. And our goal there is to get it to a level to where there's some really good certainties about that level of censorship resistance. And I think once we get to 10,000 validators that are with equal stake distribution, so it's not just full nodes, it's how the stake is distributed. that the minimum set of nodes that can halt the network is in these thousands. You get to a point where you can almost treat it like this, the metaverse or whatever, like this universal computer that's always there and you can plug into it whenever you want to. And that's the goal, right? And that will scale to light clients that can just make really small assumptions about the network. They just need a cryptographic key and they can validate like whoever's connected to this like really quickly by just with old school like signature verification. You don't actually need to validate the headers. You just need to validate, hey, am I connected to the same network as everyone, as the people that I care about? And that could be done like just really quickly. So that like the purpose, I guess if people want to understand the difference and how we're visualizing this, is that I think the purpose of this network is to be this message bus for generals. The crypto economics and all this other stuff is almost like a implementation detail. But if you can solve that and generals problem in a way that scales to any large number of users that can want to use this in some way, maybe it's to build an ERC-20 token or a community or whatever, that we don't really care, but we need to solve this core problem. So this is how we're thinking about it. And for us, like the cost to run a validator, the capital costs are like the hardware, like you can basically think about it in terms of load and capacity. So you need about 2 or 3 cores per 1,000 TPS of load. So if the current load is about 1,000 TPS, you need at least a 4 to 8 core system with 32 gigs of RAM. But what we want is high capacity, right? Because high capacity is what sets the price per transaction. And the more hardware, the better. And that always gets more better every 2 years. There's twice as much kind of horsepower per dollar. So you can either get last year's hardware cheaper, or you can get newer hardware at the same price and increase the capacity of the network and therefore reduce the price per transaction and increase the number of validators that can send those transactions for consensus. So this is where like kind of the Moore's law really plays in our favor, is that every 2 years, without changing anything to the protocol, to like the fundamentals of how anything works, the network can basically support twice as many nodes connected to it. And that's an exponential function that is like really fast, you know, when all is said and done.
Okay. So if we were to just do a cross comparison in terms of the cost of running a consensus node and a full node for the two networks, what kind of quantifiable measure, such as dollar price, can you give us?
So the main costs, because Solana requires full, you have to observe everything that the network is doing. The cost is bandwidth or egress. And the egress costs are vary depending on where you live, but typical co-location pricing is $50 a terabyte. So if you take $50 a terabyte and 10,000 validators, and you split that up, the cost per 128 byte message is about 10 to the -5. So $50 a terabyte, right? Data is replicated by 10,000 validators. So every one of these validators has to pay $50 a terabyte of egress. So when I send my 128 byte message, it's replicated 10,000 times. So I have to pay for that. Otherwise, everybody's running at a loss. And the minimum fees for the user at that scale of decentralization end up to something like 10 to the -$5 per 128 byte message. 128 bytes is enough to stuff a signature in there and a public key and some user data.
Okay, that's helpful. How about you, Evan?
Yeah, it's pretty cheap. So like we look at right now, just like the base cost of running a node, there'll be similar transaction throughput bandwidth costs on top of that. But right now it's just, you basically get access to a 4-core machine and that's about it. I don't know. I guess it's like effectively like free if you have like a computer right now, not a computer. And hopefully we will get it down to working on phones and browsers at some point. And then I think it'll be like really cheap to run a full node. For consensus, it also, if we end up having support for higher bandwidth at some point, then we'll have to pay for bandwidth also. But yeah, that's pretty cheap as well.
So I think one thing that's people often overlook is when they think about cheaper, expensive validators is that consensus nodes are highly available systems. And this is where I think like a lot of detractors of Solana say, oh, the network is too expensive to run. But reality is that it doesn't matter if ETH2 can run on a Raspberry Pi. It doesn't matter if they use sharding. It doesn't matter if they rotate that set. the nodes that participate in consensus have to be high available systems, basically run at 3 nines, which means that you can't use your phone, you can't run it on a laptop that you blink in and out of at a cafe. There's no design right now that anyone's built where consensus can run on low availability hardware outside of proof of work, where you wake up your machine, it does some hashing and gets lucky and produces a block. So effectively, if you're not doing that, if you're not doing Nakamoto PBFT, you're building a high availability network that runs on high availability nodes. And therefore, basically, like, they're all equivalent in cost. You're paying for egress, and then, like, how effectively can you use that egress? How effectively can you parallelize and scale and transmit? That's the difference between a good video streaming service and a bad one, or a good CDN and a bad one. It's just kind of implementation details, the blood, sweat of engineering.
So my understanding is that the cost of operating a full node and cost of a consensus node, the main value proposition for Mina is that these numbers are supposed to be lower. And that's why it's easier to scale and basically have higher amount of decentralization. But based on what you guys have just been saying, it doesn't sound like that cost advantage for Mina is that evident. Is that the case?
I would say it's pretty substantial, actually. So for running a full node on, it's extremely cheap, both in terms of bandwidth and in terms of compute. Like, it's the running this on your phone is not going to happen on really any existing network because they don't have the zero knowledge proof, which proves the whole history. You're going to have to do
but,
something.
But that's not a consensus node, right? That's just a node that's downloading the headers, like the ledger history.
Yeah, it's a little more than the header since it's like the whole history and approved down to like particular accounts. But yeah, so for full node, it's a lot cheaper. But for consensus, it's a little bit closer. For consensus, it's really probably just going to be pretty similar depending on bandwidth. So what I think is cool here actually is these are just two halves of this problem. And I think that consensus nodes, like, I think we do gain proof guarantees in the set of assumptions you have to make when joining the network because you get this proof as a consensus node. But the actual cost of running it is basically just also going to be bandwidth because you do have to be connected and monitoring all the transactions. The added gain with Mina is access to these cheap full nodes, whereas the consensus nodes, you got to stream all the transactions. That's where it's at.
So it sounds like, at least for the consensus nodes, the cost advantage is not very obvious. It's just when it comes to the full nodes, the difference is there.
Yeah. And we've chosen to do pretty low throughput at first because we just want to optimize really hard on the decentralization features. Our cost of running a consensus node is really low right now, but I don't want to. That's only because the bandwidth cost is really low right now. If bandwidth was to be like as high as something like Solana, then consensus nodes would be, you'd have to stream all that bandwidth. So you got to deal with that. But full nodes would still be cheap to run.
Okay. And for us, like, the bandwidth comes from increasing the number of nodes participating in consensus and reducing their block times, right? So they're producing more signatures per second. So both of those things, right, like increasing the number of nodes means that there's more signers, and reducing the block times increases the number of messages, therefore egress costs. But those are all things that benefit users because more nodes in consensus means more larger set for that like threshold, for that liveness threshold. And lower block times means that faster confirmation times.
Okay. So coming back to the main theme of decentralization and TPS here, what are some other areas in each other's platform do you see that can serve as inspiration for your own?
Yeah.
So I can start. Like, I'm like, I think the zero knowledge approach to compressing the history is really cool. And where I think that has tremendous impact outside of just Mina is the ability to build light clients that can verify that the remote chain followed some set of logic rules that the source chain can basically guarantee that, like, those header, like, the whatever proofs you're getting, they actually followed the expected logic that the source chain depends on. And that's really hard to do with other kinds of light clients. And this fundamentally goes into this assumption about how do we identify which network is real. Us as humans, we can take this side channel approach where I boot up my node and it's connected, and then I go check, hey, am I connected to the same node that I care about? I like ask Evan for his public key, and we send a message between each other. I ask Richard for your key, and we all send a message between each other, and we're like, oh, okay, we're all in the same network. But blockchains can't do that. Like a light client running in Ethereum or Solana can't actually go and validate this. So those assumptions have to be baked in. And that is where I think there's a ton of financial risk and incentives for the remote chain and collusion to break them. And I think if you have like effectively zero knowledge rollups running inside all the remote chains, then you can quickly validate that logic is correct and that the signer signed it. And then if they have to be slashed, it's very easy to do so and like cheap to do. So to me, there's like kind of, this is where I think like this stuff can really create this like internet of blockchains that Cosmos is working on. I think really depends on the improvements that Mina's working on.
Yeah. And to be frank, it really doesn't sound like what Mina's working on is incompatible with the way you guys are doing things at Solana, right? So theoretically, that technology can basically employ for your full nodes to verify history in an extremely efficient manner.
I think because zero knowledge programming, the bytecodes and kind of the virtual machines there are so different than like standard interpreted programs, I think it'd be pretty hard to build those circuits. Evan knows more about this, but maybe it's possible in the long term, but we have effectively x86. So taking arbitrary programs that are running on x86 and compiling them into a zero knowledge circuit is tough. Like it's tough to do that at scale where that doesn't require a ton of work. I don't know if it's possible in a general sense. But what's cool is that if we had Coda as a virtual machine that was shared between Solana and Ethereum, then that is a VM that we can use as a, you know, value transfer and an interface layer, right, between these two networks that is has these guarantees that the execution on both sides is doing what we're expecting to, or the signers that are validating that execution all need to be slashed. And that signature is easy to prove and show, and therefore like an insurance model built on top of this is like simple for humans to validate and run. And reducing like that cost of running that and validation and like the relayers and like just reducing the complexity there, I think would really make those systems a lot more robust.
Okay, great. Evan, were you going to also talk about inspiration from the other side?
Yeah, totally. I could talk about the general compute stuff too, but let me talk about that first. Yeah, I think what Solana's done with both speed and finality is like really impressive. And yeah, like you were saying, these things are not mutually exclusive. I think there's like a lot of theoretical and like practical engineering things that had to go into like making such like a very fast chain. There's definitely things to learn there. We've all adopted like this, we're just going to throw a linear set of transactions into a block like Bitcoin did. And there's so much more flexibility and possibility for how you can set that up that like really has major improvements. So I think that's like the big learning for me.
Those are all the questions from our side. So any last word from either of you?
I'm excited of all the zero knowledge work people are working on, especially the Mina folks, because I think it's like, I love when people take these crazy risks, doing something that seems impossible or seemed to me as totally impossible like a year ago, now seems like it's coming together. It's just really cool to watch. Just like, it's just awesome. I wish you guys the best of luck.
Thanks, you too. I think for me, what I love about this is we're all talking about like decentralization, but like decentralization has been like this like word that's gotten all these concepts stuffed into it. And when you look at both our protocols, you can see how that you can start breaking that apart and looking at the little pieces of what really goes into decentralization. Because I think it's true, you have to increase the throughput if you want people to actually really use this stuff. That's part of decentralization. And you need people to be able to get access to these things if you want them to be able to use it in a trustless manner. I love breaking apart the word and like really understanding what goes into it.
Okay, great. Thanks for joining the debate today, Anatoly and Evan. How can our listeners find both of you, starting with Evan?
Yeah, you can find us on our Twitter. Just go to Mina Protocol. And if you want to just contact me directly, there's also my Twitter, Evan A. Shapiro. So you can contact us there.
Go to Solana.com and join our Discord. And you can talk to myself and all the engineers working on Solana and a ton of our members of our community.
Thanks a lot to both. I learned a lot. And listeners, we would love to hear from you and to have you join the debate via Twitter. Definitely vote in the post-debate poll. Also, feel free to join the conversation with your comments on Twitter. We look forward to seeing you in future episodes of the Blockchain Debate Podcast, since it's optional, proof of thought required. And Anatoly, we look forward to having you come back a fourth or fifth time.
Anytime. This is a ton of fun.
Yeah, perfect. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks again to Evan and Anatoly for coming on the show. The debate evolved into a bit of juxtaposition of the approaches by Mina and Solana. Both chains claim to be able to simultaneously advance TPS and decentralization. As far as I can tell, Mina's chain with super small footprint will allow participation from a huge network of full nodes. And Solana is focusing on the throughput of consensus nodes, doing meticulous engineering optimizations and also riding on continual advancement of Moore's Law. What was your takeaway from the debate? Don't forget to vote in our post-debate Twitter poll. This will be live for a few days after the release of this episode, and feel free to say hi or post feedback for our show on Twitter. If you like the show, don't hesitate to give us 5 stars on iTunes or wherever you listen to this. And be sure to check out our other episodes with a variety of debate topics: Bitcoin's store of value status, the legitimacy of smart contracts, DeFi, POW versus POS, and so on. Thanks for joining us on the debate today. I'm your host, Richard Yan, and my Twitter is Gentso09, GENTSO09. Our show's Twitter is BlockDebate. See you at our next debate.